this out as a four-point function, I'd have propagator, 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 propagator. But the rule is for the gamma, I just get rid of those propagators. So this is the remainder, if you like, after getting rid of those propagators. And this is the tree level contribution to gamma 4. Now we can also compute one loop fractions to gamma 4 and gamma 2 and also higher endpoint functions defined this way. And I claim that this is the form of what you get computing at one loop, where you cut off your momentum integral, transform it into Euclidean space with a momentum cutoff lambda. So if you recall, we required that the Euclidean momentum squared, which we define as the Euclidean zero piece plus the speed momentum piece, is less than or equal to lambda squared when we put it into loop integrals. OK, so from this, we see that if we hadn't cut off the loop integrals going into this, we would have gotten infinities. So if we look at the two-point function, there's a piece. This is the loop diagram, and this is the counter term canceling it off. I get a piece that's proportional to p squared. And everything else has some dimensionless coefficients, a1 and a and a2 and so on. And this piece is formally log divergent. As long as it goes to infinity, I have a finite piece, and then I have a counter term coming in. Over here, I have what turns out to be a quadratic divergence, and then something that's proportional to m squared with the log divergence, and then finite things in the counter term. And I can do the same thing for the four-point function. For the four-point function, I have I have some coefficient that would be log divergent. This is some function of st and u, where st and u are the Mandelstam variables that depend on p1, p2, p3, and p4. And OK, just to mention, my different people do this differently. My convention in Feynman diagrams is I implicitly have time going this way. So it's some function of f of st and u such that this is dimensionless. And then I have a dimensionless constant. And then I have my counter term. So if I only care about these one loop corrections, I see that I can make everything finite with my counter terms. So in principle, if I wanted to cancel off the lambda dependence here explicitly, I could choose my counter term here to get rid of that, same here, and same here. And I have just enough counter terms to get rid of all these would-be divergences. OK, so but just canceling things off in an ad hoc way doesn't necessarily help us. We're just throwing the problem, sweeping under the rug. A better way to actually deal with those divergences is to relate them to experiments. And this is where the renormalization step comes in. So far, we've done the regularization step of renormalization. And then there's the actual renormalization. And that's what I want to get to next. So let's go back to the two-point function. And the two-point function, I can think of this as a correction to the inverse propagator. So and what I mean by this is that suppose I started inserting this correction into propagators. So I have my tree level propagator, and this is just like what I did with the mass yesterday, plus I have some correction, where this correction is this delta lambda 2. So at the one loop level, my full delta lambda 2 is what you see there. But at a higher loop level, like I might have fancier things that are still 1 pi and so on with more counter terms. And then in principle, I could also insert this twice. And on and on. And what happens is I get a formal geometric series, just like I did yesterday. So this bubble inserted, because I've gotten rid of the external propagators, looks like a delta lambda 2 of p. And then I have another propagator. So here, propagator, insertion, which are those loops, propagator. And then here I have propagator, insertion, propagator. So I'm going to get two powers of this, and so on and so on. And what happens is, just like I did last time, I get a geometric series. So which I can rewrite this as I over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon times a sum of n equals 0 to infinity of delta lambda 2 over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon to the nth power. So here's n equals 0. Here's n equals 1. This will give me n equals 2, and on and on and on. And then I sum this formally as a geometric series. And I get the same idea as the mass desertion story I told you yesterday, which is going to give me a 1 or 1 minus delta lambda 2 over p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And then I sum this up, and at the end of the day, I get I over p squared minus m squared minus delta lambda 2 of p plus I epsilon. So what I've done is I've taken these. So this is also why this gamma n definition is so useful. Because I've gotten rid of the external propagators, it gives me a correction that kind of fits into nicely into other stuff. Yes?
A couple of questions. What's the significance of delta first? And the second is that do we worry about the radius of convergence of the geometric series?
OK, both good questions. So the delta part is it's a correction to the tree level piece. So the tree level piece would formally be p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon. And the same thing for the delta 4. So the delta here is the one loop correction, and this is the tree level piece. So the full gamma 4 is tree level plus the delta. Okay, sorry about that. As far as the radius of convergence goes, the answer is yes and no. So implicitly, I'm assuming that these are perturbative corrections. And because they're perturbative corrections, I always have lambda. By assumption, lambda is small. And because lambda is small, if this whole approach is going to work in perturbation theory by computing at one loop, it has to converge. So the only way in which it's well-defined sort of self-consistently is if it converges. So if it doesn't converge, then this whole perturbative approach is just out the window anyhow. OK. But in any case, this delta lambda 2, this one loop correction, or in principle, I could extend it to higher loops, but it starts at one loop, I can think of it as a correction to this propagator form. So that means it's going to affect how particles bounce along as they travel. So now, if we think about propagators, and we think about the spectral theorem and the Killeen-Lehmann-Szymanczyk representation, which I think you did in QFT, remember that we associate outgoing, or we associate external particles, either coming in or going out from scattering, with poles in propagators. So if you look at our full corrective propagator, which is what this is, so our full quantum corrective propagator, our propagator including the quantum loop corrections, the form of this that we want to use in our spectral theorem, or Killeen-Lehmann-Szymanczyk So the idea is that to identify an outgoing particle, we look for poles in the propagator. And a pole in the propagator corresponds to where p squared coincides with the physical mass of the particle. So what we have at tree level is, at tree level, and we forget about the loop corrections, at tree level, this is just our propagator. and we see that we have a built-in pole of p squared equals m squared, and we identify this tree-level mass with the physical mass of the particle. But now we've included quantum corrections, and since we've included quantum corrections, my propagator now has extra pieces beyond just the m squared here. And if you look at, if you think about the form of these is going to look like something that's proportional to p squared, and something that's proportional that looks like an m squared correction, that may or may not be proportional to m squared. But the point is, even in this corrected form, with more stuff here, I can still identify the physical mass of the particle after including the quantum corrections as the pole in where the propagator lies. So there are two pieces. So first of all, there's a pole, and there's also this thing r. And the r stands for residue. So r is a thing that's left over after you cancel the pole of the neutral. OK, so what we want to do now is actually renormalize the theory. And renormalizing the theory corresponds to choosing values for the counterterms. And what happens when we choose values for the counterterms is, well, first of all, we want to choose values for the counterterms such that we get rid of the formally divergent parts. So we want to hide the lambda squared dependence in the counterterms. But the second thing that happens when we choose counterterms is we impose a relation between the Lagrangian, the so-called renormalized parameters in the Lagrangian, specifically m and lambda, and physical observable quantities in the theory. So at tree level, we have that the physical mass coincides with the m parameter in the Lagrangian. And in principle, we can choose our renormalization condition also to impose that. So let's do that next. So let's impose a renormalization condition. So my first renormalization condition is going to be, and this is a choice that I impose, but my first renormalization condition is that I'm going to set to 0. I'm going to choose my counterterm such that p squared equals m squared, where m squared is a Lagrangian parameter. This one loop correction vanishes. So this is something I'm allowed to do. This just corresponds to how I split my original Lagrangian into the so-called renormalized parameters, m and lambda, and the counter terms, del m squared and del lambda, and del z. But if I go back and I look at this story, remember my propagator corresponds, or my physical mass corresponds to a pole a simple pole in the in this propagator. And if I go and I compare it to this, this is going to correct where that pole is, but I can choose my counterterm conditions such that when p squared is equal to m squared, this vanishes. And that means that I can identify m squared appearing in my Lagrangian with the physical mass. So this is the choice I impose, but the implication of this is that m squared is equal to the physical mass of the particle squared. Now, I could choose different conditions. I could choose different conditions that differ by a finite piece, so a piece that doesn't depend on lambda. And in that case, I would have gotten a different relationship between the physical mass and the m squared parameter in the Lagrangian. So for example, if I look up at my p squared independent counterterm, if I look up at these counterterms up here, and I set p squared equals to m squared, I have some expression, and I have a set of choices to make such that for del z and del m squared, such that that whole thing vanishes for p squared equals m squared. But a different choice I could make is that instead of this thing being 0, this thing could be, delta lambda is, let's say, I could choose it to be 1 GeV squared. And in that case, my m squared would have been the physical mass squared plus 1 GeV squared. So it's a choice I make, but this happens to be a convenient choice because it relates a so-called renormalized parameter to a physical observable, the actual particle mass I see. But going back and looking up here, I have two things to two unknowns. I have two counterterms versus And I only fix a linear combination of them by imposing this condition. So I need another renormalization condition to fix this. And the second renormalization condition, this one actually doesn't require a physical observable. This is a physical observable in that I observe a physical mass, and then I say that my Lagrangian parameter coincides with that physical mass, and that fixes my counterterms. The second condition I can impose is I can expand this correction about p squared equals m squared, and then impose a condition on the first derivative. So what I mean by this is I go back up here. I go back up here, and I want this thing to be, OK, so this would be a function of p squared. So I'm choosing my counterterm such that this vanishes. P squared equals m squared. And I can then go and formally Taylor expand this in p squared. So the form of this is going to be I over p squared minus m squared minus, if I expand this formally around p squared equals m squared, I have my zeroth order component plus the leading component. So I'm doing a Taylor expansion in p squared. And then I can keep on going if I like. But if I look at this, this first correction, I've chosen this one to vanish. That's my first renormalization condition. And if I think about what this, if I look at what this looks like, this piece is going to look like an expansion close to p squared equals to m squared. I'm going to get 1 minus d delta p del 2 del p squared at m squared p squared minus m squared plus I epsilon plus these higher order terms. So OK, so that'll be good. Hope everybody can do this. So all of that I've done is I've expanded this around p squared equals to m squared. So I want to focus in as p squared goes to m squared. I want to look near the pole. And this is the zeroth order term in the expansion, focusing on the pole. This is the first order term in the expansion, focusing on the pole. And the other things are formally smaller if I'm very close to the pole. So I see that close to the pole, once I've chosen that first renormalization condition, this next correction, this first order correction, gives me a correction to, p squared minus m squared. OK, yeah, because I can factor out the whole thing. The second piece gives me a correction to p squared over m squared. And that means that if I go back and I compare to over here, this correction coincides with the residue, R inverse. And the residue, R inverse, just coincides with how I normalize my field variables. So there's not a physical observable associated with this. It's just that if you think about doing, a Feynman path integral, I have a choice of how I normalize my fields. It just, I can just shift my fields in the measure and in the Lagrangian by the same amount. So if I choose this to be 0, this corresponds to this R equals a 1 in the residue. So that's a choice that's up to me. I don't have to cancel it off. But if I don't cancel it off, when I relate my Feynman diagrams to scattering, to S matrix elements in scattering, I'd have extra factors of R to cancel off. So if you think about the Killain-Lehmann semantic representation, if your propagators aren't normalized with R equals to 1, you get extra factors of 1 over R inverse or something, or sorry, 1 over R to the 1 half when you write down scattering amplitudes. So we're just going to conveniently set R equals to 1. This gives us two conditions. And these two conditions fix del z and del m squared. And they make our theory formally finite in the sense that once I fix them, all this dependence on lambda squared, on this so-called UV cutoff, disappears. And once I cancel them off at p squared equals m squared, my one loop correction is still non-zero. But it's non-zero in a way where the stuff that's left over after canceling things off, depends on p squared, but it doesn't have any lambda squared dependence. So one thing I think you looked at in the tutorial yesterday, and one thing you'll get some practice doing in the homework, is actually working these things out, canceling them off, and solving for the remainder. So even after I've imposed these two renormalization conditions, there's still a finite one-loop correction to the propagator. But by my choice of renormalization conditions, that finite one-loop correction of the propagator vanishes as I focus in on the pole of the propagator. OK, so far we've dealt with the two-point functions. We can also go and look at the four-point function. So the four-point function, has, okay, I have the lambda piece, I've got the lambda squared correction piece with the formal infinity plus the del lambda. And the renormalization condition for this is that I can choose, again, this is just a formal choice that's up to me. But a physical threshold for first scattering, for 2-2-2 scattering, is that my two initial particles are just at rest with zero initial momentum. So this is the smallest possible initial s, and you can check that it gives you t and u equals to zero. So this is s equals 4m squared, this is equal to t, and this is equal to u. And going back and looking up at this, at the expression here, if I fix my s and t and u according to those special values, I can then solve for delta lambda. So these two conditions fix delta m squared and delta z. This condition fixes delta lambda. And what I get as a remnant of this is my scattering at other energies, at other values of s, t, and u, now gets quantum corrections that are finite. So I can, I'm trying to remember whether this is on the homework or not, but if I think about the matrix element for scattering, I have the minus I lambda piece from tree level, and I have the one loop correction. But once I've imposed this condition, my one loop correction is going to look like lambda squared c1 log lambda squared over s of s, t, and u plus c2 minus delta lambda. But now if I go and I impose my renormalization condition, that fixes delta lambda to be equal to this whole combination at the special point of s, t, and u equals to 0. So that means that the remainder, and I think you'll get to work out the precise expression in the homework. But OK, the remainder looks something like this. So what I've done is I fix my delta lambda according to this renormalization condition. And that corresponds to choosing this thing to cancel off this thing for the special momentum point s equals 4m squared, t equals u equals to 0. And then I can look at an amplitude for a general scattering amplitude for 2-2 for general values of s, t, and u. So that means that this thing doesn't depend on s, t, and u, so everything cancels out here. This thing does depend on S, T, and U independently. So what I get is a correction to the scattering that vanishes when S equals 4M squared, T equals to U equals to 0, but that gives me a finite non-zero correction at other values. So what I've done here is I fixed my counter terms in such a way that I can take my Lagrangian parameters, I can relate those Lagrangian parameters to physical observables. In this case, I've related my Lagrangian parameter m squared to the physical mass of the particle. I've related my lambda coupling to essentially the scattering cross section at this particular momentum point. And that means that in terms of these two physical observables, the physical mass and this physical scattering cross section at a certain momentum point, my theory now makes unambiguous predictions with no formal dependence on the cutoff lambda for all other momentum points. So the idea at the end of the day is I have these formal divergences. I regulate them. I control them by relating my total amplitudes to physical observables. And then I go off and I make new predictions for other observables in terms of these so-called basis observables. So my basis observables are scattering cross-section at a certain physical point corresponding to the value of lambda. That defines the value of my renormalized parameter lambda. The value of my renormalized parameter m is related to the physical mass, another observable. And now the rest of my theory, I can go off and compute and make unambiguous predictions in terms of these basis observables. Yes? It's a
very naive question. So I can measure lambda by, say, scattering two particles at S4m and t equals to 0 and u equals to 0, right?
Yes.
And how would I, say, relate? How would I, say, measure the mass of the particle, the physical mass, and then relate it to the experiment precisely?
So that's one of the things. So that's actually a very deep, complicated question. Because it's going to depend on how it interacts with matter and your detectors and all that. In principle, experimentally, we know how to measure mass of the particles as they travel through the detector. I guess you could do it by looking at a different range of energies and looking at how much energy you deposit, for example. Or you could look at processes where you, if you couple this to photons, you could look at how much photon energy you release when you annihilate two states, for example.
So there's no like simple scattering sort of answer or something like that?
I guess you could do it in terms of scattering, in terms of relating the change in scattering cross-section at different momentum points this way.
Sure.
So these are experimental issues that give me headaches. And I probably won't be able to give you a good answer. But OK, but it is an important deep question, but it's something that, in principle, we can measure. And at least physically, we have a physical idea of a mass of a particle. OK, so we've taken this very simple theory. We've just moved stuff around into so-called renormalized parameters and counter terms. We've renormalized it. And we've, even though our theory is formally infinite, we still get unambiguous physical predictions. So we don't do quite as well as we might have hoped for at the start. So at the start, we might have hoped for, OK, I just start with my so-called bare Lagrangian, this first thing. And if I just fix values of m0 and lambda 0, I can go off and make predictions for anything I want. I can't actually do that. I need these physical inputs. So I need a little bit of help beyond what I thought I did. And a little bit of help corresponds to dealing with the dependence of the so-called bare parameters on the cutoff lambda. So here, a physical interpretation is lambda represents some kind of new physics coming in and changing the theory. So I'm not allowed to integrate to infinite momenta. I have to stop it somewhere. But I don't know what that new physics is. But even though I don't know what that new physics is, it turns out that I can still make observational predictions by trading any potential lambda dependence that comes in a very specific way for these physical observables. So even though ultimately the relationship between lambda 0 and m0 and physical observables should depend on this other high energy new physics that I have no idea what it is, this isn't great, but I can get around that by taking extra input from experiment. So that's the idea of renormalization in a nutshell. But so far, I've only looked at 2 and 4 point functions. And you might worry that, OK, what about 6 point functions or 8 point functions or what have you? Do I have to worry about new divergences that aren't captured by these counterterms? And the answer, at least in a renormalizable theory, is no. And for this, dimensional analysis is going to come in very handy. So So let me get to the next. So just in passing, let's count the mass dimension of gamma n. So if I think about the mass dimension of gamma n, so I'll put square brackets for the mass dimension. It's an endpoint function. And it's an endpoint function with n scalar fields. And in four dimensions, a scalar field is of dimension 1. So because it's an endpoint function, I get a mass dimension n from all the scalar fields I put in. But our definition of gamma n also involves the external propagators removed. And by definition, this gamma n has n external propagators, and the propagators have mass dimension 2. Okay, so I'm missing an offset here. Let me just think for a second. Okay, so I think, okay. Okay, and I think I need a, okay, so I need an offset. Okay, I'll worry about what the offset is at the end of the day. Sorry, I should have thought this through. But what we see for the two-point function, the two-point function for n equals 2, I get gamma 2 is dimension 2. Gamma 4 is dimension 0. And gamma 6 is dimension minus 2, and so on and so forth. I need to sort out my argument for the dimension, but okay, it turns out these are the mass dimensions, and gamma 8 is the thing I'm missing in this is that I'm also transforming to momentum space. So the transformation to momentum space means that I Fourier transform this thing. Okay, so anyway, I'll work out the correct formula, but for 2, 4, 6, 8, each time I go up one, I go down minus 2. Okay, so this is the answer. Forget about this theory because I forgot about the Fourier transform. But okay, but you do, there's some dimensional analysis estimate, and this is what you get, and it agrees with what we see here. And the dimension of this gamma n coincides with the dimension of the coupling I'd attach to an operator with n powers of the scalar field at the end of the day. Okay, so if I look at this and I think about how it could depend on the cutoff, I'm only worried about cutoff dependence that's with positive mass dimension. So this two-point function in principle can go like lambda squared, or either p squared or m squared times log lambda, just on dimensional grounds. For lambda fourth, this is dimensionless, so it can go like log lambda. But if I look at lambda 6 and lambda 8, I don't have any more dimensional space for dependence on positive powers of the cutoff. Now, you might worry that, okay, what if I have something like lambda squared over p to the fourth? The argument against that is that all these endpoint functions should have essentially smooth limits as either p squared goes to 0 or m squared goes to 0, where p squared and m squared are the Lagrangian parameters. And that means that I shouldn't have funny inverse powers of p squared or m squared in the denominators. And that means that just based on dimensional grounds, these objects are, these things don't depend on lambda in the limit of lambda goes to infinity. So if I was to go and I compute the loop integrals, I'd find that they're all finite, and I don't get a formal lambda dependence.
So why the endpoint function should be the smooth root or p squared?
Okay, so m squared goes to zero. M squared goes to zero is a little bit sensitive, but p squared goes to zero just corresponds to my particle. I don't know, I guess the physical momentum of the particle going to zero, and there's no reason for that to diverge. This is a more technical answer, but about infrared divergences canceling out automatically. But okay, I don't want to get there. But roughly, the upshot is that I shouldn't have inverse powers of p squared over m squared, going with these positive powers of lambda. So at the end of the day, just based on dimensional grounds, I expect the two-point function can be bad. The four-point function can be bad, but all these higher endpoint functions should be OK. And there's a way to formalize this and prove the renormalizability of certain field theories based on using this as the basis of the argument. So there's a lot more to the actual argument, but this is the key idea underlying it. You just run out of dimensional room for dependence on the cutoff with positive mass dimensions. So this applies to renormalizable theories. And renormalizable theories are typically those that don't have any couplings with inverse mass dimensions. So if I look at my lambda phi 4 theory, I've got the m squared that has mass dimension 2. I have my lambda with mass dimension 0. And those are both positive mass dimension. But suppose instead I extend my theory with a new coupling. Suppose I add to my theory the following new coupling, phi to the sixth. So this is just a tree level. This corresponds to just a six-point vertex. OK, so I can now look at this theory. And in the same way as before, I could drive a specific new counter term for the phi to the sixth thing in the same way I had before. And let's go and compute the one loop correction to delta lambda to the sixth. And for now, I won't worry about external momenta. So the one loop correction to the six-point function So this is my one loop correction to the six-point function. I've taken my six-point function and I've inserted it here. I have a scalar bubble. And then here I've got my four-point vertex here. So I have four external legs here, two external legs here, and then they're the cross diagrams, but you get the same idea. So this thing goes like I get a lambda from this coupling. I get a c over m squared from this thing. And then I'm going to get a d4q over 2 pi to the fourth of 1 over q squared minus m squared plus I epsilon squared from the loop momentum running here. And if I look at this, I have 4 powers of q here, 4 powers of q here. And when I cut this off at lambda, this thing is going to look like log lambda. So it turns out that I now get a new divergence in the delta lambda to the sixth. And in principle, I could also add in, if I treat this in a normalized perturbation theory like I did before, I could also, after rearranging my fields, I'd also get a counter term for this. So I could also add in my counter term to cancel that off. And everything's looking OK. I could do the same thing as I did before. I could impose a new renormalization condition to cancel this off with a counter term. But there's a problem. So the problem comes up in that, remember, in my previous theory, without this new addition, I only had divergences in the 2 and 4 point functions. So I've put in a new operator, and the new operator has given me a divergence here. And in principle, I can cancel off this new divergence with the corresponding counterterm. So I get one new divergence, I have one new counterterm, everything's OK, I need one new experimental observable, but that's it. What I had before, without the extra stuff, I had two sets of divergences here, one set of divergences here, and three counterterms, so I was able to cancel everything off. And I didn't have any other kinds of independent divergences, so I had enough counterterms to cancel off all the independent divergences. And that means that I only needed a finite number of experimental observables to fix things up. Here I have a new divergence. I'm going to need a new experimental observable. But one more, OK, what's the issue here? The problem, though, is that if I look at the 8-point function and its one loop correction, I don't have any 8-point function in my initial Lagrangian. But there's a one loop. It's generated a one loop. With two insertions of this six-point vertex, and this thing is going to look like psi squared over m to the fourth log lambda after I compute that loop integral. And what happens now is, okay. Well, first of all, I can check the dimensions. The dimensions check up. The dimensions check up here, if you see as well. But what happens now is I've put in a 6-point function, The 6-point vertex has created an 8-point vertex with a new kind of divergence. And this new divergence is independent of the other ones. So to fix this up, I have to go back and put in a new counterterm. And that new counterterm is going to correspond to putting in an 8-point function, an 8-point vertex in my Lagrangian. But now that I have an 8-point vertex in my Lagrangian, I can generate divergences in 10-point functions, or 12-point functions, or 14, or on and on and on. And what's going on now is, before I put in the 6-point vertex, if I only had dimensionless or positive dimension couplings in my Lagrangian, I was able to bound the number of independent types of divergences. As soon as I put in a coupling with inverse mass dimension, it messes up this whole counting. And it messes up the whole counting because now I can have powers of this new coupling, this 1 over m squared, plus positive powers of the cutoff. And that's exactly what you see here. I'm making up the mass dimension of this thing with this new inverse dimension coupling, but I'm getting positive powers of the cutoff. So what we say in this case is the theory is non-renormalizable. And it's not renormalizable in the sense that, OK, in principle, we could still write down all possible operators with all possible counterterms. But the problem with that is I would need, in principle, an infinite number of experimental observables to make any kind of physical prediction. So now it seems like my non-renormalizable theory is non-predictive, whereas we saw how to make predictions in a renormalizable theory by taking a finite number of experimental inputs. So we started off, OK, so initially we hoped that our theory be finite altogether. It turns out it's not. But as long as it's renormalizable, we can make physical predictions in terms of a finite set of experimental inputs. We're pretty happy there. But now we've gone one step further, and we see that, oh, we now have these higher dimensional operators that ruin the renormalizability. And it makes it seem like I can't make any physical predictions at all. So it turns out that even this is a bit too strong. There are ways to live with non-renormalizable theories and to use them to make physical predictions. And the way to do that, though, is to think of them as effective field theories. So that's the next thing I want to get to, how to think about effective field theories, how they relate to non-renormalizable field theories, and how, even if your field theory is non-renormalizable, you can still make interesting predictions with it. OK. So the way out, I keep on using dimensional analysis, and I'm going to use it again, but it is remarkably useful. OK, so the way out is that we're going to slightly lower our standards again. So if you think about where we started with a theory where we thought, OK, everything's finite. I can make predictions in terms of lambda 0 and m 0. Turns out we can't. Let's lower our standards a little bit by getting a little bit of help from experiment. We get some finite experimental help. We can make predictions. Great. But now we've gone to a non-renormalizable theory. Things are even worse. It seems like we need an infinite number of experimental observables to make physical predictions. But OK, let's lower our standards a little bit further. And the lowering of our standards a little bit further is that we're going to only require that our theory make physical predictions up to a finite accuracy, which is a pretty reasonable thing to do. My experimental detectors can only measure things to a finite accuracy. And that means that, as a theorist, I don't have to worry about computing an infinite number of loops. I only compute a finite number of loops until my accuracy is better than the experiment, and then I'm done. So the same story goes with non-renormalizable field theories in a slightly different way. So let's go back and think about scattering through this new operator. And this new operator can give us 2 to 4 scattering of 5 particles. And let's estimate the cross-section for this 2 to 4 scattering at tree level. Well, the 2 to 4 scattering at tree level, the tree level Feynman diagram coming from this will just be set by that one vertex. And that one vertex, when I put it in, I could estimate my cross-section again by dimensional analysis. So I have one insertion of that vertex. And that's going to give me a zeta over m squared in the amplitude. But then I square that amplitude to get the squared matrix element in the cross-section. But then I have to make up the dimensions of the things going into the cross-section to make it have mass dimension minus 2, which is the correct mass dimension of a cross-section. And the only other physical scale in this, at least if I'm scattering the 5 particles at energies that are big compared to their mass, is the momentum of the scattering. So the other physical scale I can put in to make up the mass dimensions is the momentum of the scattering particles. I'm just going to call it generically p. And I need a p squared to get the mass dimension right. So I can rewrite this in a suggestive way as some dimensionless coupling squared times p over m to the fourth times 1 over p squared. So this is my cross-section, or at least the contribution to the cross-section from this new dimension 6 operator. So I'll put a delta here just to mean that this is specifically the contribution to the scattering cross-section from this new operator alone. In principle, I'd also have contributions to 2 to 4 scattering from the dimensionless lambda coupling. OK, so now if I look at this, I can look at this cross-section, and I can compare it to the cross-section I would get for 2 to 6 if I only had the lambda coupling. So the delta, so I'll call this lambda, I'll call this zeta. Through the lambda, so if I only had the lambda couplings, lambda, lambda, this would be my contribution to the 2 to 4 scattering. So this contribution is just the basic 6-point vertex. And the contribution to 2 to 4 scattering from my initial 4-point vertex would look something like this. And the delta lambda here is going to look something like I get 2 powers of lambda in the amplitude. So I square that, but I take it square again when I square the amplitude. But if I look at this diagram, the only dimensionful momentum scale or dimensionful scale in this is the momentum itself, because I have dimensionless coupling, and everything else is just dominated by the momentum of this thing going through the process, as long as it's much bigger than the mass of the particle. So the contribution from the lambda coupling, from diagrams like this to the scattering, is going to look like lambda to the fourth times 1 over p squared. So now I can compare these two contributions. And comparing these two contributions, I see that the relative size of them depends on the momentum at which I'm starting the process. So at low momenta, this is going to be bigger than this, as long as I make the momentum low enough and lambda isn't super tiny. So let's assume lambda is kind of order 1, zeta is order 1. So this will dominate at low momentum. But as I increase the momentum, this is going to increase faster than that. And eventually, this thing is going to start to get big. And for example, suppose I tried to make p on the order of m. As I start to make p on the order of m, this thing becomes order one or even bigger. And in fact, what happens is as I make the momentum larger than m, this initial piece that is morally equivalent to some coupling becomes much larger than one, and that corresponds to a breakdown of my perturbation theory. The effective coupling induced by this higher dimensional operator looks like this, starts to become very big as the momentum of the scattering becomes big compared to m. And that means that if I want to trust this whole setup in perturbation theory, and that's what I've been implicitly assuming, that I can treat all this in perturbation theory by calculating some number of Feynman diagrams and truncating the expansion, this says that if I have higher dimensional operators in my Lagrangian, this theory only makes sense as a perturbative field theory up to a certain energy. And that certain energy is set by the mass scale of the mass scale suppressing the higher dimensional operator, this negative mass scale. So the upshot of this is that, there are two things. One, this only makes sense to have these higher dimensional operators in perturbation theory for relatively low momentum. So that's the first thing. The second thing, though, and this is where the finite theoretical accuracy comes in. So remember that the problem with non-renormalizable theories is that as soon as I put in a non-renormalizable term, it will generate an infinite number of other non-renormalizable terms. I need an infinite number of counterterms. If I wanted to get rid of all of them, I would have to require an infinite number of experimental measurements, and I wouldn't have any predictivity. But the thing that comes in here is that suppose I lower my standards and I only demand a finite experimental accuracy. And specifically, I only demand a finite experimental accuracy in the region of applicability of the theory, which is at momentum much less than m. At momentum much less than m, these corrections from higher dimensional operators are numerically small. And in fact, the higher I go in the operator dimension, so if I was to go to phi to the eighth, the phi to the eighth piece would look like a phi to the eighth over m to the fourth, or I go to a phi to the 10 over m to the sixth, on and on and on. When I start inserting these into things like cross sections or corrections to physical observables, the higher I go in operator dimension, the more powers of p over m I get. So the point is that for these non-renormalizable theories, I can still make unambiguous theoretical predictions with only a finite number of experimental inputs, as long as I don't demand that the accuracy of my theoretical prediction goes beyond a certain point. Because numerically, these become small enough that even though I know these exist in my theory, and in principle I need a counterterm to cancel them off, I know in principle I can put in a counterterm, cancel off the divergent piece, I'd have some leftover. The leftover goes like p over m, but If I demand a certain level of experimental accuracy, I can cut off the set of higher dimensional operators I actually have to worry about in any calculation. So instead of keeping this whole series, I can cut it off, let's say, at this level, only cancel stuff beyond that, because I know that any operator of higher dimension is going to be numerically smaller than the accuracy I care about. So we've again lower our standards a bit, but we've done it in a physically reasonable way, in that even if we had a renormalizable theory, we're not going to be able to make infinitely accurate predictions. I don't know how to compute 20 loops. There's already that uncertainty built in. In a non-renormalizable theory, we have another uncertainty built in of a slightly different type, but it's still it's handleable in a way, provided our momentum is much, much bigger than this inverse mass scale. So the way to handle this is essentially don't ask too much of your theory.
So basically, like, we are doing perturbation theory based on the p over m to the power.
Yeah. So we're actually doing two expansions and two independent small parameters. So we have an expansion in the usual small lambda dimensionless coupling. And that's the thing you're probably familiar with in renormalizable theories. But now in our non-renormalizable theory, we also have a separate independent expansion in P over M. And the point is that we only go so far in the P over M expansion in the same way that we know that we typically only go so far in the lambda expansion. So I guess the moral of the story, and I'll wrap it up here, is that you shouldn't fear non-renormalizable theories. You should just be careful about where you apply them. So as long as you apply them at low energies, well away from the so-called cutoff M, you're totally safe. You can make accurate theoretical predictions, even though it looks like it's non-renormalizable. So we're going to look at this from a slightly different perspective tomorrow when we talk about effective field theories. And it turns out that there's a way to write, to start with a renormalizable theory, look at its low energy limit, and rewrite it in a way that makes it look like a non-renormalizable theory, but where it turns out to be easier to compute. So we'll get to that tomorrow. And again, if you have questions, just let me know.